Meister.
How do you do, sir? Are you Mr. Meister? Will you be sworn in, please, by Mr. Goodell?
Your daughter was shot.
Meister, I must ask you the same five standard questions I ask every witness. Are you appearing today and to testify under oath voluntarily? Have you been paid by anyone for your testimony other than the expenses to come to Clearwater?
No, sir.
Do you have a lawsuit against the Church of Scientology?
No, sir.
Does the Church of Scientology have a lawsuit against you?
No, sir.
Has anyone suggested to you that you should state anything but the truth, or has anyone suggested that you change your testimony for any reason?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Well, my name is George Meister, and I'm here not because I've ever been a member of the Church of Scientology or ever will, but I'm here in behalf of my daughter, Susan. And I'd like to have the camera get a shot of this picture, if possible. This is a picture of my daughter. That's all I have.
Can you get it?
Susan died aboard the ship's Apollo, June 25th, 1971, with a bullet in the middle of her forehead.
She's a beautiful woman.
So, I first received news of this death when we live in Greeley, Colorado, and my business took me over a four-state area. I was in Salt Lake City at the time. And I received a telephone call from my daughter, youngest daughter. I have two daughters. My young daughter, Robin, called me and said, Dad, Susan's dead. I said, what? She said, yeah, Susan's dead. She said, Reverend Marin is here, and he's going to wait till you get home to acquaint you with the facts of her death. I said, who is Reverend Marin? She said, he's a minister from the Church of Scientology. So, I don't know, everything became a blur. You don't think it's very straight. And cases of that kind. I mean, the shock was extreme. I have a cousin in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, who was a practicing attorney there, and I called him and I said, I need help. I'm going to fly into Denver, and when I get into Denver, I'd like to have you meet me there, because we have this man from the Church of Scientology there. Who's going to tell us about Susan's death? And he said, Susan's what? He said, yeah, my daughter's dead. So he said, I'll be there. And he was. So we went to Greeley and discussed the thing with my wife and my daughter, Robin. Then proceeded to meet with Reverend Marin. They informed us that Susan had died aboard the yacht Apollo by a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He said, we have a report here that's been that the ship put out, and it was worded that that Susan had committed suicide.
You looking for the letter from now?
Yeah. No, I'm looking for the one that report that's coming out. But we talked with the Reverend Mayor quite some time, and of course my cousin, being an attorney, had some inquiring questions, like were there any witnesses to this? And he couldn't come up with any witnesses, anyone who had seen this happen. What were the circumstances? Well, Susan died aboard the ship in the harbor of Safi in Morocco, North Africa. So the fact sheet that they put out that he gave me said Miss Susan Meister was found dead from a gunshot wound in her forehead approximately 7:35 p.m. on Friday, June 25, 1971. The door was locked and admittance to the cabin was only gained after a key had been obtained from the berthing steward. She was lying fully clothed on a bunk in the cabin. There was no pulse. The police authorities were immediately notified and the body was taken ashore to the police mortuary for an autopsy as required in such circumstances. On the floor of the cabin, the police found a suicide note which they took as evidence. The captain had all persons restricted to the vessel except for senior officers assisting the police in their investigation until such time as the autopsy was completed and the police investigation completed. The gun used was a .22 caliber target revolver belonging to another person on board. Susan knew that he had such a gun as she had watched him clean, reassemble, and replace it in a drawer in his cabin. The gun was found clasped in her hand. On the day of her death, Susan was seen aboard by many people, particularly up till 2:30 p.m. She appeared to be quite happy and not in the least distressed or disturbed. As her job entailed the delivery of communications to all parts of the vessel, this explained why so many saw her in the time period mentioned. However, in the afternoon, she was found missing at her work as clerical assistant and as a crew member looked for her and found her alone in the cabin where she later committed suicide. This was 3 p.m. and he asked her to come back to work. What she did was she was seen by her senior at 4 p.m. However, she didn't make her usual communication deliveries at 5 p.m., nor did she appear for dinner at 6 p.m. Susan arrived on board February the 19th, 1971, and although the police took the suicide note as evidence, one of the ship's officers was asked to read it to them. He stated that in the note, Susan mentioned that she wanted her possessions to be sent to her parents, especially her books, and she was sorry for any mess caused anyone. Well, basically, this is what happened. And as soon as possible, taking the time that it took to get passports and so forth, I made up my mind that I was going to Morocco to find out what happened. Morocco wasn't a new place to me. I landed there in 1942 with the U.S. Army. I was the combat engineers. And I knew what a hole that country was. But it was about 2 weeks later, maybe a little longer, that I was able to leave. And I stopped off in Washington, D.C. because I had a feeling that going over there to that country and with what little I could learn about these people, but I wanted all the protection that I could get. I stopped at the office of Gordon Allett, who was the United States Senator from Colorado in Washington, D.C., and Gordon Allett was extremely helpful. Peter Dominick was also another one of our U.S. Senators, and he was helpful. So between the two of them, they provided me with letters, and they provided me with the information that I'd need and who to see when I got to Morocco. After I left the States, went to Morocco, landing in Casablanca. It was real foggy there, I remember that. And coming in on the Pan Ams, one of those old Boeing 707s, we had to make three passes at the airport before we could finally find a hole through the fog and get down to find the field. Well, this is 3 o'clock in the morning. So as I went over to the terminal with the rest of the passengers, and I was looking around for the vice consul that I was told was going to meet me. Instead of that, my name came over the loudspeaker in the airport. I went up to this desk, and here was a man and a woman standing there to meet me. The man's name was Peter Warren, and he introduced himself, and he introduced the woman as Joni from the ship Apollo. They were from the Church of Scientology, and they were to escort me. And I said, well, where is the vice consul? Where is this government official that I want to meet me? He said, well, he had a previous engagement, and he asked if we'd look after you. Okay, so it was some 20 miles into Casablanca. We went into the Mar Harbor Hotel, and I was given a room in this hotel. And as you know, it was an all-night flight from New York to Casablanca, and I was tired, so I went to sleep. And about 10 o'clock the next morning, I got a call from the vice consul. And he came over to the hotel room, and then we start going over the facts of Susan's death, that it was by gunshot wound and so forth. And he became alarmed. He became alarmed. The man has had some previous intelligence experience. He said, I don't like this at all. And we were to go to Safi, which was about 100 miles south of the coast. So these people, the Scientologists, Warren and his Joni, were always there. I could never move without them being right by my side. So the following day, while the four of us took a car and drove to Safi. And I had a camera with me. I had some 35 rolls of film. And I thought, well, what I'd do, I'd like to photograph everything and get as much as I could on film. So we drove down to Safi. And when we got there, Jack Galbraith was the vice consul's name, and he suggested we go to the local police department and see what we could find out about it. We went to the police department, and the man who was in charge of the police was very helpful. First thing he done was show me a photograph of Susan just lying on the bunk with this hole in her head and blood running out the corners of her mouth. It wasn't a very pleasant sight. And all the reports that they showed on this death were all written in French. And of course, I couldn't read French, neither did Jack Galbraith. So that wasn't too effective. So I asked, then they showed us the box. I wanted to see the gun that she supposedly shot herself with. And they showed us a box. Just the box the gun came in, which didn't tell me much of anything. But then this picture where Susan laid in bed, they said, this is the way we found her. Her body was undisturbed by anybody until the French police came or the Moroccan police and took charge. She was lying there with the bullet hole in her head. Her arms were crossed on her chest, and in the middle of her breast on her arms, underneath her arms, was this 22 caliber long-barreled revolver. How can anybody shoot themselves in the head and then put the gun on their breast, be in between two clasped hands? How do you do that? How do you shoot yourself in the middle of the head with a long-barreled revolver holding it out like this? I think you'd have to use two hands and then you might miss. But the other thing is, in all the suicides that I know anything about, I find it very rare that a woman commits suicide by gunshot. Could be pills or something of that nature, but hardly ever a gunshot. But then we went next to the so-called hospital where this autopsy was performed, and of course we ran into the same situation over there. I asked the police before I left for these reports. They said, no, can't have any. Well, what about the picture? No, can't have it. How about a copy of the picture? No, can't have it. So after going over to this morgue, it was a hospital and extremely dirty. And of course, I don't know if, you know, most people feel like things in foreign countries are going to be the same as they are in this country. They're not. A place like Morocco is a monarchy, and of course the king of Morocco, as it is today, he runs that country totally. And whatever he says is the law. It carries all the way down from the top to the very lowest citizen. If he wants somebody dead, they're dead. It's that simple. And of course, anyone who's a citizen of this country, when you get into a problem in any of those foreign countries, even though they are like Morocco, you're subject to the laws of that country. You're, because of the fact you're a United States citizen, doesn't have anything to do with it. But in the next place we went to was the hospital, and the doctor in charge was wearing something that looked like a long white gown, and it was dirty and bloodstained. Looked like he'd worn it for maybe a week. And he had patients there, and they showed us into this operating room. And honestly, I've seen butcher shops that look better. This was where the autopsy was done. I had a man with me from the Church of Scientology, Peter Warren. And he said, we ordered the autopsy. He said, well, we had her brain removed. We had all her intestines removed. I said, why? He said, we were looking for drugs. We suspected her of using drugs. So I said, fine, where's her body? I was told before I came over by you people that her body would be in a refrigerated morgue and then I would be able to identify her. That's why I went there. I went there to identify my daughter's body because I didn't believe she was dead. I wanted to see her body. Well, he says it isn't here right now, this doctor at the hospital. He says, I don't know where it is. So we went to another place, this records house, and didn't find out anything there. We finally wound up in the office of the Pasha, and the Pasha is the same as a mayor in this instance. Well, the Pasha was a very small, well-dressed individual with a little mustache, a very arrogant little guy. He took in the whole case. I'm not to know, no reflections, Your Honor.
I'm just
they're known to be that way.
Oh, so.
No, you got to.
But anyway, he wound up telling me that, in view of everything that had happened, he said, all these records are going to be transferred to Marrakesh, which was the provincial capital, some 150 miles away. I said, if you want to pursue this matter any farther, you'll have to engage a Moroccan attorney, you'll have to wait for a court date, and you'll have to be here. How long is that going to take? Well, he said, could be a month, could be 6 months. Well, I knew it was nothing, you know, there wasn't anything further to do, and it was getting pretty well along in the day, so we decided, well, we'd better stay in Safi that night, because going back to Casablanca was about 100 miles, and the roads over there are full of wandering people. They have no homes, they just wander. And wherever they happen to be, that's where they stay. You know, the country's warm. Usually the weather's warm over there. So we decided, well, better not to hit one of them guys. You're getting in any kind of trouble. You're driving up the road, and if you happen to run into one of those Moroccan, wanderers, I suppose if the Pasha ran over one of them, that's nothing to be said, be okay. But if I ran over one of them, I think I'd be in jail forever. So we decided against that. There's a hotel in Safi called the Metropole Hotel, so we decided we'd stay there that night. We went over, and you don't do anything in Morocco without a passport. You have to have a passport to register in the motel, to get a train, to do anything you want to do. So we went over and registered in the hotel using our passports. And Jack Galbraith said, well, I told my wife in Casablanca, he said, that I was going to be back tonight. And he said, in this country, you make sure you tell people where you're at. So he couldn't get through his wife. They don't have much of a telephone system there. It runs and then it doesn't run. So he tried to call his wife. And he couldn't get through to her. So he finally called the office of the consul, and he got through there, and he asked if they wouldn't mind telling his wife that he was going to stay over and where he was. So she got the message right away, and it was about an hour later, I guess it must have been about 10 o'clock that night, in this hotel. She called down there to the hotel. She wanted to talk to him, find out where he was and how long he was going to be gone. And the desk clerk that answered the call said, we never even heard of that man. We never heard of George Meister. We were registered there. We later found out that Lafayette Ronald Hubbard had the top floor of the hotel. This was a practice that he was quite, that was usual with him in all these places where this ship Apollo was a rather small ship. I remember the thing I saw when I was overseas. It used to be a troop transport, and when I was over in North Africa in the early 40s during World War II, they were using that thing for a troop transport, and it was what we consider a small ship. But what Hubbard would do, he'd be on board that ship when it was underway, and then when they'd get in these towns, he'd take over maybe the top floor of the hotel, and he'd stay there with all his messengers and all his girls that were like the ashtray and so forth that Mrs. Hartwell described to you, and that really did happen. So, the people on board the ship would be, it was a very confining thing, very, very confining. Yeah, well, I think I'd better start in, how did Susan get into Scientology? Okay, this happened when she was, Susan was 22 years old, and she'd gone to school for quite some time, and she decided she was going to San Francisco from Colorado. So she said she wanted to go out there and work. Fine. So she and, there was about four of them that went out there. She got a job. She had a couple of jobs, matter of fact, and one job that she had was with Grolier Publishing Company, selling magazine subscriptions by telephone. And that's where she met a couple of people, and they were very interesting, and they were, learning to sell by telephone, and these people were Scientologists. They were apparently learning Grolier Publishing Company's techniques on how to sell by telephone. But she went over to this Scientology org, I suppose, what it was, on Mason Street in San Francisco, and she was very impressed at her reception. The reception room was very neat, and the girl that was on the desk was very orderly, and she was treated very well. Scientology was really presented to her first class. And she was impressed. She really was impressed with this. So she just kept going back. And then she began, she got this free personality test. She liked that. Then we got a letter from him and stating that she was in the Scientology and that she thought it was something that was real good. And she was interested in it. So this was in the fall of 1970, And then she wanted to go to Los Angeles. She said, in order to pursue this further, in order to become more advanced in this thing, it'd be, it's necessary that I go to Los Angeles. She came home for Christmas in 1970. And then she went back to San Francisco, and I think she left there in the latter part of January. She went to San Francisco, and that was the last time we ever saw her alive. But she went to San Francisco and or to Los Angeles. Then we found out later that she went from Los Angeles. She didn't stay there very long, but she went from there to New York, to Lisbon, Portugal. And from Portugal, she went to Casablanca, and that's where she caught the ship.